Ladies and gentlemen, go blue, and please welcome Dr. Mark Schlissel.
Thanks very much, Ralph. That was extremely kind. If you went on for another minute or two, my work would be done. We'd be on to questions, but only kidding. So welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming, braving the weather. Thanks to my colleagues from our campus in Dearborn and my Ann Arbor colleagues that are here today. Shout out to these wonderful high school students that the DEC brings here. I'll tell you, when we get to the question session of the program, the questions these kids asked me today, I'm sure, are harder than the questions you're going to ask me after this talk. So thanks for the invitation to speak today, and it's really a pleasure to be here among so many leaders who are engaged in creating a brighter future for this great American city. We're proud to be your partner in this important endeavor, and in fact, we've spent a great deal of time this past year focusing on how we can be an even more valuable university. Throughout our year-long bicentennial celebration at the University of Michigan, we've been examining what we offer to communities all around the state, particularly here in Southeast Michigan. My answer to questions about UM's value has three parts. One, as a research university, we make the state and communities we serve more prosperous through innovations that drive economic growth and create jobs. Two, we prepare many of our state's most talented students to succeed and to fully participate in a global society through top academic programs and opportunities unique to a public university of our breadth and our scale. And three, we make the quality of life better here, not just for our graduates, but for everyone. And not just through research and education, but also through our galleries and artistic performances, the cutting-edge healthcare provided by Michigan Medicine, and our outstanding athletics teams. So I'm a scientist at heart, and I could share huge amounts of data to support each of these points, but instead, I'll just offer a few illustrative examples. First of all, public value and service are in our DNA. 200 years ago, the legislative act that created the U of M envisioned a university that would serve the public good. The act provided for the creation of colleges, academies, schools, libraries, museums, and other useful literary and scientific institutions consonant to the laws of the United States of America and of Michigan. The original vision had incredible degree of foresight. The greatest strength of a place like University of Michigan is the confluence of research, teaching, performance, and patient care, which come to life in our galleries and libraries, our classrooms, labs, hospitals, and clinics. A Michigan without one or more of these elements would no longer be Michigan. Over the past two centuries, I believe U of M has exceeded these venerable concepts of public usefulness more than any other university in the country. One way to illustrate this is by a show of hands. How many of you here today went to U M, have an immediate family member who did, or a colleague at your company who did? I should have asked who doesn't. I mention your work colleagues because we know Michigan grads get hired. Our Ross School of Business reports that more than 190 companies hired the school's graduates in 2017. Amazon topped the list by hiring 39 MBA and BBA graduates to full-time jobs this year. In fact, Amazon hires more Michigan grads than those from any other school in the country. McKinsey and Company was a close second, extending 38 full-time offers across the programs. The report shows that 97% of our full-time MBA graduates and 98% of BBA graduates from the class of 2017 received at least one job offer within 3 months of graduation. It's also no surprise that the graduates of our top five ranked engineering college do similarly well in the job market, with many heading off into the automobile or technology sectors. But it might surprise you to learn that the graduates of our College of Literature, Science, and the Arts do just as well. 96% of our liberal arts graduates are either employed or in graduate school or professional school within 6 months of graduation. In fields like education and research, in the nonprofit sector, healthcare, consulting, law, and banking. Employers are looking for workers who have broad skill sets and can tackle complex problems, work in groups, communicate clearly, think carefully, and collaborate across cultural differences. A Michigan education doesn't just prepare you for your first job, but rather for a dynamic career in a rapidly evolving and globalized economy. We rank amongst the tops in the nation for the value we provide to the general public as well. We're the number one public university in the nation in research productivity at nearly $1.5 billion of research last year. We're the number one public university in the nation in students earning prestigious Fulbright grants, and we have been for 12 years in a row. We're the number one university in the nation in producing physicians who save lives in hospitals and in communities like ours. At U of M, cars drive themselves, robots walk, and our graduates lead. In the past year alone, U of M graduates or professors have won a National Book Award, an Oscar, a Golden Globe, two Grammys, three Tonys, a Pulitzer Prize, and three MacArthur Foundation Genius Awards. Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, Ann Arbor Mayor Christopher Taylor, and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder are all proud U of M alums. Our alumni also include one United States President, two dozen governors, three Supreme Court justices, eight Nobel laureates, and the winningest quarterback in NFL history. Michigan impact is literally everywhere you look. It's in the books we read, in the hospitals and clinics that heal. It's in the schools that educate our children. It's the way we feel when we hear the voice of James Earl Jones or experience the Big House for the first time on Saturday in the fall. It's also where we dream. Our research is the basis for the thrusters that may take humans to Mars and advances that are key to curing previously untreatable diseases. And just think, we've been doing this now for 200 years. Nowhere else are legacies of excellence and impact like ours measured in centuries. What sets us apart is that education and research are interdependent and synergistic at the University of Michigan. Our students get to learn from faculty who are literally peering around the edges of human knowledge and understanding, and framing questions that will drive us and our society into the future. Students learn that evidence and facts matter. They learn to question what they're taught, and they learn to be purposeful in their studies. While a majority of our students are from Michigan, we attract bright and hardworking students from every state in our nation and from nearly 120 countries around the world. And once students from outside the state get to know Michigan, they're more likely to stay here for work or for additional education. Of course, Detroit is the first community we served as a public university. Detroit is the city of our founding. Before the university moved to Ann Arbor in 1837, our first building was here at the intersection of Bates and Congress, just off Woodward Avenue, about 1,500 feet from right here. Our Bentley Historical Library has artifacts that date back even farther. In its collection is a copy of the first printed map known to show the city of Detroit by name. It was created in 1703 by the French cartographer Guillaume de la Halle. I believe the University of Michigan and the city of Detroit will share a future that is equally significant to our wonderful past together. The work we do as a university with Detroit and its leaders and with community partners in its neighborhoods provide terrific examples of how interests of cities and research universities are not only mutual, but they're inseparable. In prosperity, in hope, and in our will to create a better future for all. At the University of Michigan, our efforts take place on many levels and across nearly every academic discipline. Our schools, colleges, and faculty members are leading research and teaching programs in collaboration with partners here in Detroit. Their activities address all manners of challenges. For example, the U of M Arc Prep program through our Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning provides intensive coursework to high school juniors here in the city interested in designing future communities. This is a terrific partnership with the Detroit Public Schools and private sector supporters. The medical school partners with Cass Tech High School in helping students explore career and other opportunities in healthcare fields. Our School of Public Health, working with several community partners, released a public health action plan with recommendations for reducing air pollution in Detroit. And the Center of the North End Neighborhoods Resurgence is a nonprofit called the Michigan Urban Farming Initiative. The initiative is capitalizing on the farm-to-table movement. It was started by two U of M students from our Ann Arbor and Dearborn campuses with funding from our programs that support entrepreneurship. Groups involving thousands of students are engaged each year in community-based service learning and research projects that involve working alongside residents who are creating a better future for their city. And they learn from many of you, the leaders of our community. I will also never forget a reception we held at the One Woodward Building for U of M students who were working as interns in Detroit companies, my first year here in Detroit. Literally hundreds of young people, full of energy, full of excitement, sharing their experiences in the city, working in all different sectors. There were students working in nonprofits along with students working for research and development companies, many people working for government, a large representation of folks in the Quicken Loans family of companies with Dan Gilbert and others. The energy around Michigan graduates, soon-to-be Michigan graduates, looking at the lifestyle in Detroit and the economy of Detroit was palpable and bodes very well for the city's future. An important part of our work at the university is ensuring that these types of educational opportunities are available for talented students throughout our state. Starting next month, many students attending Michigan will do so under our Go Blue Guarantee. This is a new initiative that promises 4 years of free tuition to in-state undergraduate students from families with annual incomes of up to $65,000 a year. That's about half the families in the state of Michigan will qualify for free tuition at one of the greatest public universities in the world. These students will receive up to 4 years of tuition if they're admitted to the Ann Arbor campus and if they meet certain other requirements. They'll also receive additional financial aid for books and room and board and other costs, depending upon their individual family circumstances. The Go Blue Guarantee builds on our longstanding commitment to help all Michigan residents with financial need afford a U of M education, including those who make well above this $65,000 threshold. About 70% of our in-state undergrads receive financial aid, and for those students, the cost of attending the University of Michigan has actually gone down over the last 10 years. And we'll continue to work to increase our financial aid, both to undergraduate and to graduate students. All of this is possible because of the generosity of our donors and careful financial management and the priority we place restraining the growth of tuition. We consider financial aid one of the most crucial investments we can make in the future of our state. We're also working intently to broaden our reach, to make sure we can identify and attract talented students from all types of communities. We began the Wolverine Pathways program in 2015. It provides after-school, weekend, and summer enrichment and mentoring programs for more than 600 and eventually up to 1,200 talented and committed 7th through 12th graders in Ypsilanti, Southfield, and here in Detroit. The goal is to get them ready to apply and to succeed in college, hopefully at the University of Michigan. As part of our bicentennial, we've spent the year looking forward with purpose. I believe the U of M's success in our third century will be measured in part by Detroit's success. It's the largest city in Michigan with strengths and challenges and opportunities that model many urban areas in our nation and around the globe. A public university like the University of Michigan is at its best when our commitments to research, teaching, and service all work together to leverage the greatest possible impact for the communities we serve. That's a value that other types of institutions simply can't provide. It takes a research university striving towards the highest levels of excellence with deep and enduring ties to the community, its history, its ambitions, and its people. Many of UM's existing initiatives are taking this collaborative approach. Take, for instance, major research endeavors like our M-City test facility for autonomous and connected vehicles and our M-Foresight initiative for advanced manufacturing. We're the founders, along with the federal government and a university in Ohio that I'm just not allowed to say, of a public-private partnership called LIFT, or Lightweight Innovations for Tomorrow. LIFT works to develop and deploy advanced lightweight materials manufacturing technologies and implement educational programs to train the workforce. These would not be possible without researchers from multiple disciplines and industry partners from economic sectors that have long driven innovation in our state, no pun intended. Our Poverty Solutions Initiative is cultivating existing and new partnerships with local stakeholders, philanthropists, and policymakers. I'll tell you a story about how this initiative was born. When I arrived at the university, I came to realize that our greatest strength is our outstanding breadth. But we're organized into 19 separate schools and colleges, each one of which, like law and business and social work and medicine and public health, follow their own disciplinary imperatives. But it occurred to me that there isn't a problem out there in the world that we couldn't make progress on if we tapped into this breadth of excellence. So I wanted to look for a social science initiative. So I invited to the president's house for dinner the deans and a senior faculty from the schools of public policy and social work, education, law, business, and our liberal arts school. And what problem out there couldn't that brain power tackle? I went around the table and I asked them, look, what are you and your colleagues interested in working on that can really make a difference for the society we serve that you think would benefit from collaborations from the other types of disciplines around the table? And to my surprise and to my gratification, poverty came up. If you think about it, you know, certainly the School of Social Work, public policy, law, business, the liberal arts with economics and social sociology and history. What a powerhouse set of collaborators. And that's how this poverty initiative was born. Our goal is to build knowledge about what does and doesn't work in alleviating poverty and to test applications of that knowledge in our community, to do the equivalent of randomized controlled trials like medical people do on the billions of dollars of poverty amelioration programs that exist in our country that really have barely moved the needle, certainly in intergenerational poverty. For instance, our faculty is working with more than 80 community stakeholders to implement the Detroit Metropolitan Area Communities Study. We know that in addition to reinvigorating the city, new investments are also raising questions about how communities and neighborhoods should make use of scarce resources to bring about positive change. Our new study provides high quality and up-to-date information on how Detroit residents themselves feel about the most pressing social and economic issues that they face. Poverty Solutions is collaborating closely with the mayor's office and partnering with foundations and philanthropists that are committed to the city's future success. Additionally, our nearby UM Dearborn campus has built an outstanding legacy through its focus on metropolitan impact, in which students and faculty work closely with local companies and organizations. I envision many more examples in the years ahead. The University of Michigan's greatest strengths include its amazing breadth and scale. From medicine and nursing and public health to law and social work and public policy and the arts and education. And as we begin Michigan's third century, one of my top priorities is to promote greater synergy and deeper collaboration among faculty, students, and staff of all of our 19 schools and colleges and our major research institutes that are doing Detroit-focused work. We've also launched an examination of our Detroit Center, currently located downtown on Woodward, to consider the current scope and future potential of the U of M's research, teaching, and service and engaged learning work in Detroit in the years ahead. This work will result in specific recommendations regarding an expanded future physical footprint in the city that Ralph may have given away, as well as the principles that guide our work. On a personal note, I'll always remember the tour of Detroit that my wife Monica and I took a little more than 3 years ago, just before I started my job at the university. We met with community leaders and Detroit residents, and we saw an absolutely remarkable city. We've been inspired by Detroit residents who've never stopped working to better their hometown. This includes many U of M students and civic and business leaders, many of you who are here with us today. My commitment to all of you is that we will look for ways to reach higher and farther in our work together and add new dynamic chapters to our centuries-old partnership as a great American city and a great public research university. In his inaugural address in 1951, U of M President Harlan Hatcher emphasized the crucial role of research universities. His words remain true today. Our young people are going out into a complex world, he said, which reflects this massive extension of knowledge and the resulting complications of managing the world which has thereby become increasingly interdependent. The most essential instrument created to serve them in this need is the university. We will rise or fall by its success or failure. It must succeed. I want to close with a brief story about one of our graduates who exemplifies the entrepreneurial spirit of Michigan students and the societal impact I've been talking about today. And this is one of my favorite stories to tell. It's about a young woman named Grace Shaw, who was born here in the city of Detroit. Her dad worked for GM, and she recounted coming home and finding auto parts on the kitchen table, which I'm not sure is an experience I've ever had. But she was born here in a hospital in Detroit, and it turns out she was born a little bit more than a month premature. And because of the outstanding medical care she received, she's gone on to thrive and got her engineering degree from Michigan. She studied engineering and business at the U of M and graduated a few years ago. As part of her education, her capstone project was to identify a societal problem and then figure out how to solve it. Very practical. So she hearkened back to her own infancy where a baby incubator saved her life, allowed her to survive as a premature infant. And she had learned that around the world each year, at least a million babies die, premature babies die, particularly in developing parts of the world, because there's no electricity, there's no incubators. You can't keep these babies alive. So that was her senior project. How do I solve that problem? And she invented a device called the IncuBlanket. This is it. Doesn't require electricity. It heats on a chemical basis. The heat lasts for several hours and is chemically titrated to, in effect, replace body heat and save a baby's life. This thing is now being deployed all around the world. Grace started a company called Warmaloo, which conducts research into these technologies that can give warmth and support upon deployment. You can imagine many other uses for this. Since I last spoke about this, I spoke about this in Mackinac this past year, her company received a $100,000 investment from an accelerator that was co-founded by another Michigan alum, Dahani Jones, a former U of M and NFL football player. This thing is now being used in settings of disaster relief. It can be used for pain management. And of course, Donnie says we should use it in the stadium on cold days for people that sit on cold seats. So this is what Michigan's about, right? It's research, it's education, it's talented students making a difference in the world. And Grace is the definition of the kind of student Michigan produces. So look, thank you all very much for the opportunity to speak to you today, for your support of the university, for working with us now and into the years ahead. Until then, and always, go Blue. I believe we have time, if I didn't go on too long, we have some time for questions, and Ralph Gershon will sort of moderate or call out some questions. I know many of them have been sent in via this electronic modality.
Thank you, Mark. We have a challenge here to come up with some tough questions, so I've been working on it, and there are some good questions. So here's the first question. From pre-K to higher education, the environment for public education is undergoing dramatic changes, and in some ways the U.S. is falling further behind. What is needed to turn this around and make American public education a world leader again?
Yeah, so obviously an incredibly important question. I would actually reject that question. I don't think K through 12 is going through enough changes right now. I think for all the great success that the city of Detroit has had, for example, Detroit will fail if it can't solve its public school situation. If families can't move here and send their kids to local schools, they'll go somewhere else. And unfortunately, it's not just Detroit, it's not just our urban centers. Our state as a whole is lagging in educational achievement K through 12. We're lagging in college achievement. We're lagging in preparing our students to be able to go on in higher education. It's very hard for me to put my finger on the why of this. I think it's not just money. What I think it is having high standards, having high levels of accountability, empowering parents to hold their elected local officials to account, and actually voting in a way that puts people in office that want to tackle this profound problem on behalf of our children. And again, it's not just money, although we're not in the upper tier of expenditures, we're not at the bottom, so we're underperforming based on the investments we have. I'm not an expert at all on K through 12 education, but one of the very surprising things to me is how many school districts we have in the state. We've got hundreds of school districts in the state. Many of them are very tiny. And that requires a huge amount of administrative overhead, a lot of administrative talent, that might be better spent organizing perhaps larger and more synergistic districts. So yeah, that's a non-expert suggestion. But I would certainly recognize as a university educator that the state of Michigan will not be successful in the century ahead, regardless of the outstanding talent in this room and the investment capital that is coming into our state, unless we can grow our own children to be vibrant contributors to an evolving economy, and that 100% requires education.
Thank you. You're trained as a physician. What can universities learn from the healthcare industry when it comes to innovation?
Yeah. So, you know, the University of Michigan is extremely fortunate in that we have a wonderful healthcare system. We were the first university, it turns out, to own and operate our own hospital over 100 years ago. So we're continuously learning from one another. And what we've done is we've merged the leadership of the medical school and the health system into a single executive vice president's position, who's also the dean of the medical school. So we're continuously learning from one another. In medical education, and hearkening back to my own education, education tends to be very theoretical. You know, we want people to understand the basic underlying biology of disease. Physicians are very practical people. They have a patient in front of them with an illness or a quality of life, and the physician's job is to improve that. So helping ground our scholars who are learning the underlying science of medicine with the practical nature of the understanding of what's really important by clinicians that are laying hands on patients, it improves the quality of our education, and then it helps transfer brand new knowledge about the latest discoveries in medicine to the doctors that are actually taking care of the patients. So that's the kind of learning from one another that our university excels at, and that happens at many great academic medical centers around the country.
Have all the recent sexual harassment stories across the country caused the university to review internal employee faculty conduct policies?
Yeah, so the university, you know, for many decades has had policies in place about the workplace, policies in place about students and how they treat one another, and then relationships between faculty and students, staff and students. We try to be extremely vigilant, not just in the recent era that we're all reading about in the paper every day, but on an everyday ongoing basis. You know, we owe all of our employees a workplace that's free of all kinds of harassment, a workplace that provides equal opportunities for people to advance in their careers. One of the things that we did just this year as part of our diversity and inclusion effort is a very detailed climate survey where we asked really detailed questions. What is your, and it was done anonymously by a survey research firm, so people were able to provide us with their unvarnished answers. You know, what is your experience working or studying at the university? You know, have you been the victims of prejudicial treatment, of harassment, of any kind of unfair practice? And we do this kind of thing all the time. The survey was a good news, bad news. Over 70% of the respondents to this survey said they thought the university was a wonderful and enriching environment, a great place to work. They were extremely happy to work and study at the university. About 18% or so of people said that in the last year, they have experienced episodes that they interpreted as being discriminatory. And you might imagine some of the discrimination is gender, some is race, some is ability versus disability, sexual preference, the things that we all struggle with in human society. We've got an office of institutional equity, forgive me for blanking on the name, OIE, that's responsible for gathering and investigating all issues that get brought forward. We've got multiple ways for people to bring forward questions about the environment that they're in, harassment or otherwise. There's a hotline. You can go to a supervisor, an HR person, a department chair. There's an online form, then we'll get back in touch with you. Many of us are subject as mandatory reporters, so if we hear things in our environment, we're obligated to raise the level. So this is an enormously important area. It would be disingenuous of me to say at a place that has tens of thousands of employees and 45,000 students that there were no episodes of this type. But I can say that we work through education and then through investigation and action to try to make it as supportive a work and study environment as humanly possible.
How is M-City doing, and what role can it play in helping Michigan to become the epicenter of mobility and autonomous vehicle innovation?
Sure. So, you know, M-City that Ralph mentioned, many of you have heard about because we've been talking about it now for a couple of years. It's on the North Campus, the northern part of the Ann Arbor campus. It's a 32-acre test facility for autonomous mobility. It's really an open-source facility. We've done this in collaboration with 60 or more private sector companies, state, local, and federal government agencies, and then our university, Michigan State, and other universities. And companies come and they try out their new technologies in collaboration with our faculty and sometimes involving our students. I don't think it's fair to say to make Michigan the home. Michigan is the home of mobility. We all know that. And in order to remain in this really important position for our state's economy, we have to be continue to be the leaders in R&D when it comes to the evolution of mobility. Some people are thinking of cars as computers on wheels, but I think Michigan's great advantage compared to Silicon Valley and other parts of our country that I've come to appreciate is Michigan actually knows how to build things, build objects. Computers, you can load up a car with computers and turn the switch and nothing happens if you don't know how to build a car. So we're the perfect place to continue to be the home of R&D. The American Center for Mobility in Willow Run is the next generation of M-City. It's a cooperative endeavor led by the state, but also by our university and other private sector partners. And the idea is to make that the federally sanctioned test site for autonomously mobile vehicles when a company wants to introduce them into the market. And having that here in our state will continue to lock us in as the home for R&D for next generation mobility. So I think it's exceptionally important. M-City is signing up new generations of sponsors and collaborators. It's a busy place. It's a mock city. It's got a building facades and overpasses and train crossings. It even has potholes like the roads we deal with.
On the topic of Richard Spencer's request to speak at the University of Michigan, does the U.S. Constitution or our current societal issues weigh more heavily on your mind?
Oh, gosh. So the U.S. Constitution and our societal issues are inextricably linked, right? You know, I think our strength as a nation is we have an outstanding Constitution and Bill of Rights to rely on in times of crisis, but also in everyday times to guide us, as to express our shared values that have survived now through multiple centuries, even longer than the university has been around. But for you know those of you that haven't paid close attention, the University of Michigan makes space available on campus to rent. So I'm guessing that some of your businesses have convened meetings on our campus. People have weddings and bar mitzvahs on the campus. You can you know get married on the 50-yard line if you want to. You don't need to be invited. You don't need a host. You just need to pay a rental fee, and that's fine because you know we're a public institution. We should be making these beautiful public spaces that we all pay for together available to the public on an as-available basis. So a representative of Mr. Spencer, you know, signed up to rent a space. And I'm sure because of the discourse around him, you know who this fellow is. You know, he's one of the most extreme versions of a white supremacist, a racist, an anti-Semite, proudly so, and it's pretty remarkable. He's had speaking engagements in many public settings, including recently at universities, where protesters and counter-protesters come, and sometimes these even get violent. So when it was announced that he had asked to rent a room, you know, many of our students and members of our community says, no way, don't let this person come here. You should never allow something so terrible to be here. He speaks against our values. He's, you know, sort of doesn't believe in us. How can you make me so unsafe? The darn problem is we don't have a choice, right? You know, as a public official, I'm not going to knowingly violate the law. And the law says I can't make decisions about renting space based on the presumed content of that speech. you know, so I can't do it. If the students say, well, look, you know, say no, let them sue you, so at least we'll know you're on the right side. I'm on the right side. I don't believe in this racist and anti-Semite, okay? However, the Constitution's incredibly important, maybe more so now than it is during some other recent decades. If we were to be say no, we'd be sued, as he's done to other universities. We would surely lose, according to all the legal advice I get. And what we do is turn this person into more of a hero in his own community. We lift him up. We also make it a little bit more difficult for us to have an event that's safe, because the Constitution and the case law around this does allow us to control the time, place, and manner of speech so as to promote public safety and not to interrupt or interfere with the basic conduct of our business. So we reached out to him and we're engaged in some discussions with a representative to determine if we can find a time and place where we think he can safely come and give a talk at the university. And those discussions are ongoing. I have no interest in hearing what he says. You know, I've seen him on YouTube, I've seen him on the evening news. I think he's a professional provocateur who knows how to poke people in the eye with a stick and will go away when we stop paying attention to him. So the approach the university is taking is the one that we have to follow the law. For a moment, this is teachable for our students and maybe for all of us as a community. What's more important now to our nation in our current moment than the First Amendment, than the five protections of the First Amendment? It's not just free speech, it's the freedom to convene, to assemble. It's the freedom of religion, it's the freedom of press, it's the freedom to petition your government. You know, imagine a government official saying, lock those reporters up in a cage. They're putting out fake news, they're against our values. We cannot be on the wrong side of the First Amendment. So we'll protect the safety of our students and our community. If we can't do a safe event, we won't do it. And we can defend that if it's based on public safety. But we're also a nation of laws, and those laws have what allowed us to survive and thrive and lead in the world for centuries. And the University of Michigan is not going to let that down.
Looking back, what would you like people to say about your tenure as University of Michigan president 20 to 30 years?
That I hired Jim Harbaugh. Only kidding. Well, I'll tell you, the thing I spoke about today is certainly the thing I'm most proud of, the Go Blue Guarantee. And if we could set up a situation where the rising generation knows and expects that if they do well and work hard, it doesn't matter what zip code they grew up in, doesn't matter if mom or dad have a lot of education or a little education, doesn't matter if they're coming out of the foster system, they can have a great education and we'll help them do it. You know, if this really does catch on and we develop the finances to be able to extend this model to the other campuses at the University of Michigan, that's enough for me.
So we're going to end today on what's called a bit of a lightning round. We're going to ask for very quick responses from Mark. So who's the person you would most like to have lunch with, living or dead?
Oh, living or dead. Oh, that makes it even more interesting. Oh, wow. Well, although I've met him, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Congressman John Lewis. So. Congressman representing Atlanta, U.S. Congressman in Congress for 30 years. He was a civil rights leader as a young student at the shoulder of Martin Luther King at the Edmund Pettus Bridge and got his head beat open for wanting to assemble under the First Amendment and march for civil rights back in the 1960s. And, you know, this person who literally had his head busted open by his country has spent his entire life serving his country, and he's now in his 70s. And he tirelessly travels around the country. We had him on campus a couple of weeks ago to tell his story, to help people remember and to help lead a rising generation. So I think I'd love to sit and have lunch with him.
What's one of your favorite songs?
Oh, dear. Well, I just had a birthday with a zero at the end, so I'll say Yesterday, the Beatles song Yesterday.
What was your favorite team growing up?
Oh, goodness. So I grew up in the New York era as a New York Knicks fan in the sort of Walt Frazier, Earl Monroe era of the New York Knicks, and I'm a lifelong basketball fan.
What's the last book you read?
Well, I'm almost done with a great book by Walter Isaacson called The Innovators. It's really a history of the development of digital technology, starting all the way back with the first thoughts about computation and digital computation to the invention of the electronic computer, all the way up through the development of the internet. So it's just fascinating. I recommend it highly. It's very readable.
What's your go-to website?
Well, I should say the gateway for the University of Michigan, but it really isn't. I'm a news junkie, and I still believe that outstanding journalism is critical for our functioning as a society. So I have the New York Times open on my screen every day.
What's your favorite vacation spot?
Well, I'll tell you, the up north of Michigan is surely becoming my favorite. Sleeping Bear Dunes here in the state of Michigan, as a East and West Coaster, having never visited the state before I began my wonderful job here, the first time we visited Sleeping Bear Dunes, I said, why do people go to Cape Cod or why do they go to the Pacific? This is absolutely gorgeous. So I'm going to say Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Could you describe Detroit in one or two words?
Wow. Vibrant and optimistic.
What advice would you give your 25-year-old self if you could?
It's hard to remember my 25-year-old self. I think, and I don't know if any of you can identify with this, but I've always been a really talented student, very book smart, pick things up really quickly. And you think that when you're young and smart, you know it all. And it turns out that the value of experience and what you learn by living, I undervalued as a 25-year-old, and I've come to value more and more as the years go by. So I counsel 25-year-olds I'm not telling them not to be ambitious and assertive and in your face and sure of themselves, but also to be respectful that you learn by living. And that's an important kind of knowledge that most 25-year-olds don't yet have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Slissel, thank you for including us in your 200th anniversary celebration. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, President Mark Slissel. And an outstanding job moderating questions by Ralph Gerson. Thank you, Ralph. And ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for attending today. We wish you happy holidays. We hope we can see you next Monday when we recognize Beth Chapel and her 15 and a half years of service. But most importantly, drive safely home. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.